This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Good evening. I'm Graham Burnett, and you're here at Cabinet for a celebration, discussion, and, as it turns out, on the fly, substantial critical response to Plot by Tirdad Zolgar. Now, I'm Graham Burnett. I'm one of the editors at Cabinet, and it's my privilege to introduce our two panelists this evening and maybe to say just a couple of framing remarks about lists in general, Cabinet's place therein, and their possibilities for literature, both realized and imagined. And then I'll turn things over to Richard Seaberth. Richard Seaberth, professor of French and comparative literature at NYU, the editor of Ezra Pound, Poems and Translations, and the translator of books by authors including Gérard de Nerval, Walter Benjamin, and Friedrich Hölderlin. And after Richard talks a little bit about Plot, we'll come back over to Tirdad. It's Tirdad's party. Tirdad is a writer and curator. He teaches at the Center for Curatorial Studies at Bard College, and we are celebrating the publication of this new book. His first novel, yes? Second novel. What was the first novel?
Softcore,
about which more anon.
Later.
Lists. So, you know, it's worth saying that there's been a kind of flurry of list interest in the last 4 or 5 years. In 2009, Umberto Eco, as many of you will know, presided over a list extravaganza at the Louvre, a year-long series of exhibitions, lectures, and projects that interrogated the form in a host of poetic and practical instances. And shortly thereafter, Lisa Kerwin curated a similarly themed, smaller show at the Morgan Library here in New York. I also have a soft spot for a sort of subgenre of list history and list preoccupations. There's a kind of history slash discussion of to-do lists, and we may return to those before the evening is done. Sasha Kagan's to-do lists, From Buying Milk to Finding a Soulmate, What Our Lists Reveal About Us. It's worth saying that Cabinet itself has played something of a role, I'd like to suggest, in stimulating attention to this form of kind of paratactical enumeration. Cabinet's own inventory column, which has been in the magazine since the first issue, right? Since the first issue. So,
vaguely, yeah.
Sina carefully instructed us to speak into the mic because this is being recorded for all posterity, and then he just spoke off the cuff like that. So in the permanent recording of this moment, those words will be lost. So you heard them, and there will be no more. Without further ado, let me hand things over to Richard to get us launched.
Thanks so much. And thanks to Sina, yes, ex-student of mine, and thanks to the great Wunderkammer that is Cabinet Magazine, and thanks to Tirdad Zolgar for your wild and crazy new novel Plot, which I've been dipping in and out of on the PDF version that Sina sent me. Generously, Sina also included for me a list of those pages in the book where lists occur. So he listed the lists so I could just move directly to them. As I understand it, but please correct me, the title Plot on one level carries with it intimations of conspiracy, a kind of Pynchon-esque paranoia about elusive agents secretly colluding in some sort of nefarious intrigue, perhaps the kidnapping or abduction of one Sergeant Jim. Plot, on the other hand, simply refers to the way in which, to use the Russian formalist distinction, the fabula, the raw material materials of the story are organized into a sujet, i.e. into the chronological order of the story's retelling. Plot is also a book interspersed with lists, which we are here to celebrate and think about tonight. On page 52, for example, the narrator describes a game called Paramount, in which the characters occasionally partake for fun and relaxation. This was, I quote, a self-devised game that consists of little more than the act of drafting long lists or wish lists or neighborhood hit parades, a group therapeutic bonding thing, thinly disguised as a noisy general knowledge contest, channeled into drunken marathons lasting well into the morning hours almost every night, usually with the overexcited neighbors joining in. It goes by the catchy name of Paramount, though some of the neighbors seem to prefer calling it Top 10. So far, it's included Paramount mineral waters, Paramount uses for a plastic bag, Paramount symptoms of estranged labor, Paramount Hegelian sublimations, Paramount ways in which Sergeant Jim is gentrifying the bungalow compound, Paramount celebrities you would sleep with, Paramount neighbors you've slept with, and so on. The players add their favorites, and each item is revisited one by one, and the list is supposedly boiled down to a single top choice, according to a variable system of rhetorical merit that I still haven't cracked but am soon to decipher. I think this is a very wry comment on sort of the contemporary relationship of listing to ranking, you know, top 10, who's number one, critics' choice, this kind of the way that the list, which should be a profoundly democratic and anarchic kind of textual form, actually is in the service of sort of hierarchical systems of ranking. On the next page, we find the narrator's first list, his first complete Paramount set, and it runs, I quote, 1, boiled chicken, 2, fried chicken, 3, baked chicken, 4, roasted chicken, 5, Kentucky fried, 6, chicken ham, 7, chicken kebab, 8, minced chicken kebab, 9, McNuggets, 10, cordon bleu, 11, coco vin. And this is a perfect example of, since I'm here to play the mock professor, of the Jacobsonian sort of two axes, the paradigmatic axis of substitution as opposed to the syntagmatic axis of combination, the axis of metaphor versus the axis of metonymy. Here we see that the list is absolutely dominated by a kind of a single vertical paradigm or seam or set, as our narrator calls it, which is basically chicken plus cuisine, whose declension is then followed through its various gastronomic or cultural varieties. This kind of verticalization of the list, in which we have a paradigm out of which we choose a series of items that are essentially substitutable, shows actually the way in which the list is so deeply related to the fundamental structures of poetry. And here we see how the paradigmatics of the list stands in opposition to the syntagmatic of narrative or of plot. And I guess what my question is what is the relationship of this book to this syntagmatic notion of plot that is constantly being interrupted or perhaps deconstructed by, in fact, the paradigmatic, metaphoric, essentially poetic practice of lists? Because what we have here is not a narrated action or event, but merely an enumeration, a paratactic series of numbers linked only by the principle of equivalence or accumulation or saturation, and no reason that the list should end up with item 11, coco vin. Indeed, the Paramount list on the very next page, top mammals reminiscent of human beings, ends up with number 7 intentionally left blank, and the list involves 1, killer whales, 2, pandas, 3, squirrels, 4, blue whales, 5, raccoons, and 6, poule de luxe. Here's the French again, akin to the coco vin that concludes the previous list, but it's, of course, a term that more or less violates the anthropomorphic paradigm of top mammals reminiscent of human beings, because it means, in French, high-class horse. The seventh item on the list remains blank to indicate, I imagine, that all lists, unlike, say, plots, are unfinished, or rather unfinishable, that is, potentially infinite. That infinity of lists, the title, as it turns out, of this smashing exhibition that already mentioned, presented by the Louvre in Paris in 2009 and organized by ECHO. And I hope we can talk about sort of your experience here as a curator to actually list making. So far we've been looking at very simple kinds of lists, examples of what Umberto Eco calls conjunctive as opposed to disjunctive enumeration. But what do we do with a list like the following? It's a list from an ancient Chinese encyclopedia called Celestial Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge, a list of animals, divided into those, one, those that belong to the emperor, two, embalmed ones, three, those that are trained, four, suckling pigs, five, mermaids, six, fabulous ones, seven, stray dogs, eight, those included in the present classification, nine, those that tremble as if they were mad, 10, innumerable ones, 11, those drawn with a very fine camel hair brush, 12, etc. 13, those that have just broken a flower vase. 14, those that at a distance look like flies. You've, of course, recognized the quotation from Borges's The Analytical Language of John Wilkins, which is quoted at the very outset of Foucault's Les Mots et les Choses, The Order of Things, as the text that, quote, shattered all the familiar landmarks of my thought. He writes, quote, what is impossible is not the propinquity of the things listed, but the very site on which their propinquity would be possible. Borges, he notes, quote, adds no figure to the atlas of the impossible. Nowhere does he strike the spark of poetic confrontation. He simply dispenses with the least obvious but most compelling of necessities. He does away with the site, the mute ground upon which it is possible for entities to be juxtaposed. A poetics of the non-sight, therefore, as Smithson might say, or more specifically, as Foucault points out, a list of things that could only be juxtaposed in the, quote, non-place or in the heterotopia of language. I detect the shadow of Borges and of Foucault in the following list on page 96 of Plot. It is the political manifesto of, quote, an obscure episcopal offshoot of the Weather Underground, found in an office wastebasket. Its conspiratorial imperatives have a kind of Chinese-y mad Maoist ring to them, and although supposedly an archaeological scrap of the Weather Underground, politically and epistemologically, it is like Borges's Chinese encyclopedia, completely off the wall, that is to say, utterly without ground or sight. These are bullet points. The points one must pay attention to always: bite marks on one's hand, the ringing of bells, any crystalline forms of sulfide. Second bullet point. That which the master treats with great prudence, odors, strategy, and sickness, people shouting their approval 15 times. Third bullet point. Three benevolent pleasures, the color maroon, the taste of orange seeds, and leading an army to defeat. Fourth bullet point. Three malevolent pleasures, fake walls, slim majorities, and all the various forms of umber and tintabulation. This is an example of disjunctive rather than conjunctive lists, as Eco would put it. To conclude this quick sampling of listitude, in this work plot. I'd like to comment and quote on a passage that presents itself as a kind of a history and theory of the list, a meta list, as it were, and I hope this will open up into our discussion and into the Q&A afterwards. This is entitled Select Notes from Fern on page 134. Lists form the very core of language. First traces of language were inventories, grain, cattle, women, trophies, slaves, offspring, human sacrifices, moral commandments, and so on. And yes, I mean, at the core of language is obviously some desire to enumerate the roll calls of ancestors, the inventories of gods, et cetera, but more precisely, as these German scholars of Listenwissenschaft remind us, list-making, list-keeping, numbering, accounting lay at the very origins of writing in Sumer in the 4th millennium B.C. So, I mean, I would restrict, I would like to emphasize the relationship of lists precisely to the emergence of writing, because you write things down, say the number of oxen or bushels of grain in a commercial transaction, that you cannot possibly keep in your mind. Writing allows for a form of externalized or prosthetic memory, but at the same by the same token, this is the to-do lists, you write things down, you make lists so that you can forget things, so that you don't have to be constantly thinking about them. And then you typically forget where you put the list, so you make another list. But so I would insist, I would really insist on the technology of writing as forgetting here, or at least on the extremely complex interaction between oral cultures that, say, someone like Jack Goody has written very luminously about. That's why it's interesting. This passage continues. The verb to listen derives from list, which in turn was the old English term for boundary, usually the boundary of a field, which why it came to mean place of combat, as into to enter into the lists. And this is certainly absolutely spot on, but also, revisiting the OED today, the etymology of list also points to a far more specifically textile and therefore textual and writerly sense of the term. I'm hammering in here on the technology of writing in relationship to list. Yes, it means border, hem, bordering strip, but more specifically, a strip of cloth or other fabric, especially the selvage or edge of a cloth, usually of a different material from the body of the cloth, and hence a band or strip of any material, a line or band conspicuously marked on a surface. Lists are often typographically arranged as bands or strips, you know, indented, which gets us into the whole, we can talk about this, Derridian territory of bords, border lines, différence, and so on and so forth. This list about lists continues. I'm about to finish here. Lists look functional to us today, but in antiquity, lists were reviled by classical poets as uneconomic, as places where language unveiled itself as excessive and entropic. Like a ruin or a metaphor, a list is potentially endless. Even when it does come to an end, it does so on the auspices of a tacit, etc. This is really interesting, and I hope we can get into this. Lists, therefore, are very, very close to the kind of very ambiguous status that description has in classical rhetoric. Descriptions are basically structured as lists, and they represent, especially vis-a-vis narrative, a problematic surplus, a problematic excess, a place of ornament. This is why when you're reading a Balzac novel, you skip the descriptions. You know, he goes on the invention of paper for 20 pages. You want to get back to the plot. So again, what is the relationship between kind of this surplus, this kind of remainder, this excess, this of listing and by extension of description, which has listing at its core, to plot. Final bullet point, and then I'll stop here. Made by our narrator. Rococo playwrights were major list makers, as were the Parthian troubadours long before them. Both believed in the practice of piling up fragments endlessly without any idea of a goal, increasingly intensifying the repetition of cliches and prototypes in the hope of some miracle unfolding. And I was delighted to find here a major passage from Benjamin's The Origin of the German Trauerspiel book smuggled into this list. I will read the Benjamin: "That which lies here in ruins, the highly significant fragment, the remnant, is in fact the finest material in Baroque creation, for it is a common practice in the literature of the Baroque to pile up fragments ceaselessly without any strict idea of a goal, and in the unremitting expectation of a miracle to take the repetition of stereotypes of intensification." I'll end here because this raises the very interesting question of the relationship of lists to the fragment, to the remnant, even to allegory, and especially in this example here, to quotation. To what extent are all lists actually forms of citation? But we'll stop here, and I hope we can talk about all.
Answer, author.
Thank you so much for this, Richard. It's an honor to have someone like you respond to a book like this. Thanks for that. Thank you, Graham, for being, you know, the moderator, and thanks, Sina, for allowing this to happen. Shea Cabinet. I'll very briefly respond to your response, then I'll read from some other lists in the book, and then maybe we can address some of the other questions, the many questions that you raise in a discussion. So you, at the very beginning, if you'll allow me to back up, you referred to the paranoia on the one hand and the ranking on the other that is, you know, contained within the term plot, the title of the book, and very shortly after that, you were wondering about whether this had anything to do with my curatorial profession, and of course it does. Ranking and gatekeeping is seen as part and parcel of the curatorial privilege. And the fact that curators do not stand up for criteria, stakes, hypotheses, allow them to exert this gatekeeping function with all the more clout and mystique. And this is also where the paranoia and all the accusations of collusion come in. As a curator, I've always, not always actually, this is more recent if I'm honest, but I've tried to be more transparent and to push colleagues and artists as well to be more inclined towards hypotheses and positions and stakes clearly stated. But today I'm here as a writer, so I have the prerogative of smug innuendo. And someone else can do the pushing and push me to the best of his abilities to be as transparent as necessary. I will simply respond to what you very eloquently described via Jakobson, the vertical seams, the paradigmatic paratactical successions. The relationship between these lists and these various ideas around notions of plot stems from an appetite or a desire even to speak about particular political dramas and traumas without indulging in the voyeurism that would come to us naturally when we engage in these things, the kind of voyeurism that is exemplified actually in many curatorial projects these days in contemporary art museums. And I was trying to opt for not to dispel voyeurism, but to engage in one that is a little more shrewd, a little more reflexive, maybe the kind of voyeurism you see in the pages of Cabinet, the kind of voyeurism you would also see in certain strands of stand-up comedy, or in the novels of Dennis Cooper, who was an important author for me over recent years, big influence on this book. So it was an attempt to impose a particular mode of narration, which it unfolds as if you look at the book, even if you just flip through it, you'll see that it unfolds as a sequence of emails, blogs, snippets from chat rooms, and other bits and pieces of text that are floating in the web. There's no narrator. There is a plot, and there is a problematic surplus of plots, subplots, misleading plots, plagiarisms, citations. And the reader is pulled along by this logic of the list along lines which, as I was hoping, would lead to a particular kind of disposition that does not allow for a very easy finger-licking type of reading of what are actually supposed to be, painful political developments. The other ruse I came up with was trying to set the whole plot in the near future, a few years down the line, not too long, and the scenario is as phantasmagorical as it is actually semi-realistic. The scenario is that the entire Middle East is at that point called New Zion, and the whole area has been compartmentalized along completely new lines. But that's, I think that we can get to that later if that's of interest. Let me read a few lists at this point, and then the more juicy ones, I'll try to go for the crowd pleasers that have sex and heartbreak and that kind of thing.
You've already offered us finger-licking voyeurism.
Very excited. I'll actually start with something drier. How much time? I'll give myself 5 minutes or so. One of the characters teaches in a writing school. And here is a list of advice for writing students. Treasure the feel and texture of your working tools, the stiffness of plastic casing, the flat luster of the screen, the slim pressure of touchpad foil against your fingertips. Appreciate the contours of the words before you, the aura and feel of a word that ends with an A as opposed to a B. Number two, cherish every member of every possible readership, even my wife, even the guy on the flight who scratches his armpits and spits into his napkins. Picture him in your mind's eye as you type. Thirdly, always do what it takes to make your professors feel like they're different from other professors. Four, always include at least one acrostic, along with 3 to 4 sad things in life, such as censorship or male melancholia. I'll move on. The list goes on, but I would rather offer a cross-section of different lists. There is another character who is engaging in research for an upcoming book on couple busting, which is trying to separate couples, which you think should be separated for some reason or another. First of all, always assume fidelity is a decision, not an emotion. By sending anonymous gifts and notes to either partner, you spark new appetites for secrecy and adventure. Second, pretend you're admiring differences as you prey on them. You're such an unlikely couple. Or, I love the way opposites attract. By watching them together in public, you can spot the weaker link in the relationship. That was number three. Number four, once you've spotted the weaker link, you target its self-esteem. Highlight whatever is common knowledge already. If she's aware of the thunder thighs, you go, hey, you don't have short legs at all. One more list, which is... one more list, which is written in anger on between two female protagonists in the book. She introduces this list by saying, I've put together a little something for you, a list, incidentally, a real bad infinity of fuck buddies, one after the other. The kind of list that may give you a more realistic idea of what you're up against when you call my sex life wretched. And she goes through a very long list. I'll start with Hank. Hank, all arounder, salsa, rumba, merengue, 6-course home-cooked meals. Fucks me like a jackhammer and does amazing things with his fingers, but falls in love hopelessly and immediately, and worst of all, very genuinely. Another thing, Hank loves to wear cowboy boots whenever he can, which invariably makes him look like a child at a costume party. Walt. He cries when he comes, just as his online buddies had mentioned beforehand. Thank God they warned me, since it's pretty disconcerting the first time it happens, shocking even. But gradually you learn to love it, even start to feel disappointed or insecure when it doesn't occur. The problem is that he really likes to hang around, like the chunks in the instant soup that don't dissolve, which of course can be okay. However, the chunks in the soup are savory in their own way, while Walt just floats there pointlessly, more like coffee creamer blobs in a Nescafe. Dean. Lots of good things to say about Dean, but Dean is so white, as in racially speaking. Physical effort makes Dean's pale white neck and shoulders go bright pink, bright, bright pink, as in fluorescent porky pink, as in excited tissue shades of pink. Very scary, not nice. Maybe we'll end with Saul. Just as big and beautiful as Drew, but the guy just wouldn't go down on me even when I asked him to very kindly. Plus, coming to think of it, I really didn't like the man's laugh. When Saul laughs, he gasps and splutters like a small drowning child. The lists are written by the four different protagonists of the novel, who write them through their own perspectives, priorities, and writerly temperaments. And the one thing they have in common is that they're all writers, but very different kinds of writers. And they engage in a political abduction, which is the backbone, the plot of the text.
So it falls to me to see if we can specify some sites to maybe get a conversation happening here a little bit, and I'm going to go ahead and call one. We have a novel that's entitled Plot that's all about and made up of lists. And Professor Seaborth has already drawn our attention to a kind of convenient antithesis between the acts of listing and narrating. And you went so far, if I heard you correctly, as to suggest, and this was kind of exciting for me to think on, that in a way, listing is much closer to the kind of soil of inscription. Mm-hmm. And let me see if I get the argument right. It basically goes something like, narrative is the ultimate slash primordial mnemonic. If there's a story, you know what's coming next. So you don't have to, like, you don't have to remember, because that's the whole point. Like, it fit together. And so what's going to come next, just in the old bardic tradition, you basically know, because you know the story. Mm-hmm. The problem with situations that call for listing is that there's no connective tissue, because there's no set of acts or situation that have kind of causal or explanatory nous. So it's in that situation that you're suddenly like, was it 17 sheep I had and 3 vials of olive oil? And if it's that, there's no way to make a... You could try, again, mnemonically. If we had Four here, he might tell us a story about how to make a story out of that in order to remember it as a mnemotechnical maneuver. But absent that, you're screwed. So you take out your stylus and the wet clay, and you start being like, you know, cuneiform, this, that, and the thing. Have I got that roughly right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So maybe then, since we've got this, we've got a book that between its title and its stuff would seem to be, if you like, trying to square that circle or get up over in an aufgehoben sort of way, that dialectic. Shall we start there with the stuff of narrative as against the list, and well, whether writing per se is part of that story.
Yeah, I mean, this was just a kind of a hypothetical move on this book, because I had not read it in its totality. I had just read it in its fragments. Again, Sina gave me the list of lists. Other pages seem to have floating bits of narrative to go with it. So, I mean, this was just my kind of hypothetical construction of it. But, I mean, this distinction basically between narrative and listing, or narrative and description, the only successful example of this, we go back to sort of the way in which lists are always seen as sort of this problematic area of excess and surplus, or just display of virtuosity, or even worse, display of sort of the labor value of the text, which, you know, in classical rhetoric should be totally effortless. You know, lists show too much work. Lists are often about technology and work. The only place that actually in the classical tradition, and you think about Lessing, where there is a perfect fusion of description and narration is in Homer's description of Achilles' shield, right? And this is the place where...
I thought you were going to do the catalog of ships.
No, not the catalog of ships. No, it's in Lessing, it's here's the perfect example where showing, describing, and telling come together, because you see, in fact, it's all about sort of the genesis and the making and the poiein of the shield. So here's the effortless thing. The Homeric catalog is actually on the other side of sort of
primitive
archaic enumeration. Now, much to be admired, but you know, on the order of amplificatio, amplification, and infinitization, and so on and so forth. There, I mean, just gorgeous pictures in this. You should all try to get a look at this book version of the Louvre exhibit of sort of, you know, the multiplication of ships and. It's absolutely amazing, the kind of vertiginous, but no, it's the shield of Achilles, which is the perfect scene, as the perfect synthesis of that. Now, I don't know, in this novel, and I you know, this is what I'm dying to hear about. From Tirdad, whether you intended that there be a kind of a deconstructive non-dialectic, but nonetheless, you know, between the listing and the plot, or whether you're actually taking the list as a way to show that all of these floating elements of plot are actually just simply as radically inscriptive and paradigmatic as the list would be, right? That's what I want to discover in this book.
I mean, I don't know if it pulls it off, but it is trying to insinuate that it doesn't have to be a dialectic between these two poles that you've been describing. It tries to even take the very, what you called the most primitive form of enumeration, archaic form of enumeration, not only as its point of departure and degree zero, but even as its structuring refrain, and it attempts to posit a kind of seamlessness between what is recognizable as a list immediately and what would in other settings be seen as an email or...
But in the passages that you read toward the end, you actually, these would be descriptions of characters. When you're giving sort of Hank and da-da-da-da, what otherwise would have been a novelistic description, you kind of expose as simply a list of attributes. I don't think there's much description in this novel, right?
Descriptive
passages.
Well, descriptive. It depends
like
what you would
call realist, Updike,
Maybe not. But on the other hand, even though you would at first glance see even that crude list of fuck buddies as something that is referring to people and places. Beyond the novel, or I guess, in every list, it's referring to something somewhere else, a list of chores, a list of things.
But you have name, gender, and attributes.
And yet what happens, or at least I hope what happens, is that you learn more about the speaker than you do about the items and the attributes that are ascribed to them. That as you go through the various types of lists that these four different protagonists keep engaging with, that you also start to see a signature within these various types of activities according to who is speaking. And you learn much more about the person who's trying to concoct this list than you do about
them.
You
refer to them as speakers, but they're always, when they're listing, they're engaged in specifically this thing that you do when you're writing. We do not make lists when we speak. We make lists when we write.
Is that... I'm not sure.
So let me come in there and ask a slightly. So I'm going to come in and ask a slightly different question that'll pull us. Not that we can't keep drilling down on the book, but let's come back around to the book this way. So I think we've set up that there's a particular kind of preoccupation with lists that is characteristic of the period, certainly from the kind of Borgesian moment forward.
And it's a preoccupation with the relationship of the oral to the written. That's what I was kind of getting at, right?
So let's try. I mean, I'm a historian, basically, and my appetite at this moment is to feel around toward, if you like, a historical diagnosis of this moment's, that is the last 25 years, histrionic preoccupation with this. And there are a couple of like really obvious moves that we make. You'd say, look, it's a moment, the failure of grand narratives, mm-hmm, and so mm-hmm. it's a basic kind of resort of a post-structuralist mm-hmm. malaise. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go ahead and float a slightly different one and then want to kind of hear from you guys. If I dig in and think, list now, this moment, say, the post-war period, since the 50s.
Which war?
Two. Yeah, two. And it's weird. Why is it that when historians do it, they usually mean the Second World War? The really terrifyingly powerful form of list that has not yet come up, that has become nothing less than, if you like, a kind of a metonymy for rationality itself, is the algorithm. Okay? So if you could do worse than offer a history of the idea of reason as a sequence from something like, you know, rules or principles, think 17th and 18th century, across to kind of laws, think 19th century, to something like algorithms.
We're getting into Foucault here and epistemic shifts, right?
You might, I mean, you could offer such an account using the kind of historiographic architecture that interests Foucault, but you wouldn't even need to. You could do it kind of old school, high intellectual history of ideas. Upshot is algorithms, which are lists, basically, are extremely powerful ways of thinking about reason and about action. They have been enormously important in the social sciences. Their significance has largely been driven by the development of computing in the 20th century. And what's interesting about the list form of an algorithm is that it's a way of breaking down very complicated procedures that have a kind of apparent internal logic into stepwise functionalities.
Which is what gives me my list that comes up on Netflix or Pandora.
For instance.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go ahead and throw out there that the kind of literary obsession with the list at this moment actually, tacitly, I'm not sure it knows this, is a kind of rattling the cage of algorithmic rationality since sort of 1960. It doesn't know it's fighting back
very
against
nice.
That, but it's that's what it's trying to do. Thoughts?
Let's hear it.
Well, that's interesting. I thought you were going to go, because this is a political novel. I love this notion, but since this is a political novel, I thought this was going to go to, you know, the notion that some people on the far left have, is that our president gets up every morning and goes over a hit list, you know, for drones, you know, that actually, you know, the kind of military usages of also kind of listing and inventory and cartography, and I don't know whether, because I think your algorithmic thing is that's a really interesting idea. How would that graft on to your attempt to write also what you've alluded to as a political novel? You said we would get to the Middle East and its meta-Zionization eventually.
the algorithmic subtext is entirely Graham's addition to this, which I'll gladly take on board and plagiarize at the next opportunity. And I haven't fully understood it, I'll also openly admit. Maybe you can go back to that later. But as far as the political optimism is concerned, that is tucked away within the gesture of resorting to this form of matrix, maybe. I'll back up for a second. The reason I began writing fiction to begin with is it's largely Sina's fault. It began with two essays that I wrote for Cabinet magazine 11 years ago, one on urban housing in Tehran and one on a prison experience, a prison narrative. And after their publication, someone harassed me into turning these essays into a more prolonged narrative about living in Tehran in the early zeros. And it became this novel, Softcore. And the irony is that throughout its reception, this novel Softcore was seen as actually largely non-fictional, except for the bits about the housing project and the prison narrative, which were assumed to be entirely invented. And I was actually quite satisfied with this inversion because it meant it would evade the kind of sensationalized ethnic marketing or mystique that is often attached to a particular narratives from the Middle East that have this political spice to them. And so when it came to the second novel and the fact that there was still this appetite to grapple with these political ingredients and yet not having a form to address them that beside the first time around it was just a lucky coincidence of a misunderstanding, a productive misunderstanding. I began to break down into its